Coming up on Path to Zero.
What if we could capture carbon either in solid form or gaseous form and use it in advanced chemistries and advanced materials so that it becomes part of the built environment? The entire conversation around the future of energy changes dramatically.
Welcome to Path to Zero, the podcast about clean energy and the journey toward a low-carbon future. Your host is Tucker Perkins, President and CEO of the Propane Education and Research Council. Now, here's Tucker.
In this episode of Path to Zero, we're joined by Dr. Ken Medlock, one of the nation's most respected voices in energy economics and policy. Dr. Medlock is the Senior Director of the Center for Energy Policy at Rice University's Baker Institute for Public Policy, where he leads research on everything from global oil markets to hydrogen and electricity policy. His latest publication, Energy Insights 2025, tackles some of the biggest issues shaping our future, from supply chain resilience and energy security to the rise of data center power demand and the realities of the energy transition. Ken, welcome to Path to Zero. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here, Tucker.
We're going to have a good time today and really glad to have you. And I know a lot of our people probably don't realize the value of Rice University and particularly the Baker Institute's Center for Energy Studies. It's one of the places that I think for all the years I've been doing this is a place that you go and see a lot of data collected. I guess you're known for a data-driven, nonpartisan look at the global energy challenges. You've just published Energy Insights 2025. What big questions were you looking to answer with that work? And what was your goal? Tell us about the purpose of Energy Insights 2025.
It's a great question. We started pulling together the thoughts of different fellows and scholars here at Rice that work specifically with the Center for Energy Studies on energy last year. And so last year was our inaugural edition of Energy Insights. It was much shorter than this year's version. I think there were 12 articles last year, 20 this year. The idea is really to just pull into very brief, succinct, sort of commentary format, the thoughts of the collective wisdom, if you will, of scholars and fellows across Rice University. It allows us to think about what's been going on, what that means going forward, make some forward-looking statements and even some proposals that aren't necessarily predictions of the future, but more about things that could be viewed as guideposts or things to think about. And so what you're looking at when you look at Energy Insights is really a collection or a distillation is probably the better way to say it, a distillation of the research that's ongoing across multiple verticals within the Center for Energy Studies.
It's really valuable work. In the end there, you point out a lot. We'll talk about some of it, but you start off by talking about energy security depends on strong and resilient supply chains. Why is that so important, and particularly why is that so important right now?
It's always important. It's especially important right now because it seems periodically we kind of lose our way when we think about what energy security means. And I think one of the most underappreciated points, just when you look at the history of the global energy system, and you know, historically, when you talk about history and you think about energy security, those who have been in the, you know, in the energy business for long enough immediately go to oil, right? And they think about the Arab oil embargo of the 1970s. It's one of the most studied sort of periods of time in energy economics that there is, right? But what that led to was pretty remarkable, but it also unveiled a lot of really important lessons that we can carry forward. In particular, the U.S. government and governments around the world that are energy importing governments really stepped in and to try to sort of disconnect, if you will, U.S. energy independence from U.S. economic health. Same thing happened in Europe. Same thing happened in Japan. In fact, Japan was a really interesting example of where over 70% of electricity prior to the Arab oil embargo was generated using oil and oil products. And they took a pretty radical shift to diversify their energy supply and did so by launching nuclear, expanding LNG, doing more coal. And at the end of the day, it led to a much more resilient system. And you've seen that really in different to different degrees all over the world. So in the United States, multiple policy interventions, you know, from a ban on oil exports to oil import quotas, to creating the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, to CAFE standards. So that's the fleet efficiency standards that we saw adopted in the late 70s. To market liberalization efforts. What's interesting about all of those things, no matter where you go in the world and you think about what actually is still with us, it's actually the things that deepened supply chains, made them more resilient, made them, gave them an ability to withstand shocks, if you will, to the system. So when you look at history, it's actually very telling because it kind of reveals a truth that sometimes we don't always really come to until we have to, which is namely, if you want a supply chain to function in an unimpeded way, you need for that supply chain to be resilient. Now, what does resilient mean? It means you have to be able to withstand unexpected events. So you can get there multiple ways. You can create new avenues for trade, redundancies in an energy delivery system. You can think about multiple trading partners. You can think about, you know, deepening relationships with existing trading partners and potential new trading partners. And at the government level, that can be diplomatic efforts. At the commercial level, you know, you get into how do you deepen contract relationships, you know, supplier agreements. I mean, all these sorts of things. It's something that anybody in the business that's actually involved in a commercial transaction space understands very well, but they don't always pull it together to really understand, I think, what the bigger picture is, which is you're developing depth along your supply chain so that you can continue to operate and do business in the lowest cost possible way. Governments, for whatever reason, don't always connect things like that. And it's equally important when you think about this at a macro level to develop depth in markets, redundancy in markets, so that you have multiple avenues to achieve the same end goal, which is sufficient energy supply so that you can drive the macro economy forward.
Well, that's a thorough answer. Thanks. It's funny, I'm coming out of meetings this morning where we've literally spent the morning debating energy independence, domestic energy security, and resilience, and kind of the intersections, but really primarily the differences. And I find you really speak to it well as you think about nations need to think about it differently than perhaps companies, than perhaps individuals. But as you were talking, I was just thinking back many instances, Europe, for one, would, I think, be in a completely different situation today had they thought about resilient supply chains differently 5 years ago. The tendency is just to go for cheap now without necessarily thinking about resilient for the future.
So that's a great point. I mean, bringing up Europe, you know, what happened just a few years ago when Russia invaded Ukraine really changed the whole dialogue around energy in Europe. It really highlighted the importance of resilience in supply chains, diversification along supply chains. If you go back to the winter of 05, 06, and then again, winter of 08, 09, there were two disruptions of Russian gas into Europe that were driven by pressure reductions across the pipelines that run through Ukraine because of disputes over transit fees and offtake agreements. And that kind of sent shockwaves through Europe. And there was a real concern about how do you deepen and diversify supply chains for natural gas? And there was interest in developing LNG import infrastructure, of course. That didn't really happen, but a lot of the sort of pre-feed work, if you will, was done. Turned out that that was pretty valuable because it allowed them to very radically and dramatically increase LNG imports when Russian supplies were cut off just a couple of years ago. So it's a very stark reminder in real time of how important depth is in supply chains, the ability to access multiple sources of supply. We actually did some work on Russian gas into Europe, gosh, back in 2008, 2009, where we simulated what would happen if there was a 9-month disruption in Russian supplies to Europe. And what you actually saw in the modeling work we did was radical growth in LNG import capacity, expansion from, you know, multiple different places. And back then, of course, the U.S. wasn't in play as an LNG exporter, right? It's a different world then. But we actually showed that because of that, Russia would lose market share in Europe for about 15 years. Fast forward to today, and you actually see a world in which the U.S. has utterly transformed the global LNG marketplace. You know, you think about what the U.S. means for global LNG. It is the ultimate driver of liquidity in that market. And that brings all sorts of energy security benefits, both domestically and abroad, that you didn't have before. In fact, if you need a way to think about it, imagine if Russia invaded Ukraine instead of in 2022, if it had happened in 2016. Right? It would have been a very different outcome because you didn't have U.S. LNG to sort of come to the rescue. The fact that that supply is now available on the water, there is a, you know, transfer of title at the tailgate of the LNG export plant. So when you load it on your ship, you can take it wherever you want to, which is why there's so many portfolio players now in that space. And if the highest price is in Europe, they go to Europe. If it's in Asia, they go to Asia. But it's a dramatic example of where that liquidity, that depth in the market is actually yielding significant energy security benefits. So, I mean, we're seeing it play out in real time. So it's not really a mystery. It's just connect the dots.
You know, let's stay on the theme for a bit of U.S. LNG. You've written about it being a big win. The expansion of U.S. LNG is a big win for global energy security. Where do you think that goes over the next 5 or 6 years? You think we continue to build that market? I guess last time I looked, it was about 11%, I think, of natural gas in the U.S. We were exporting about 11%. And I feel like the last time I looked, we were exporting 16-17%, which is interesting because as a professional around LPG, we export about 70% of the propane that we find in the U.S. But clearly that nat gas market is growing. We got more and more trains being built, more and more ports exporting. Where do you think natural gas goes?
We'll continue to see expansion of exports as long as they are commercially viable. So really,
do you think that means as long as the arbitrage is available, or do you think eventually we will maybe monkey with the arbitrage?
No, it's about what are the gains from trade, right? It is what is the arbitrage window. You know, I think we are approaching very quickly a period, and this is a combination of growth and supply that you're seeing in the U.S., but also stated plans out of places like Qatar, what you're seeing in East Africa. We're gonna approach a point, given all that supply growth and given some of the ailments that you're seeing in terms of global economic growth, where the market's going to flip to become more of a buyer's market. There's going to be an abundance of supply available on the water. And buyers are going to be able to basically go into the spot market and get really good deals for gas. It won't be the first time that happened, by the way. We went through a similar kind of window about a decade ago. But usually what happens then is you'll get relatively low prices. That puts the brakes on expansion on the supply side. Demand, of course, will accelerate when it sees that sort of favorable condition in the market. And then you'll move into another period where all of a sudden you need long-term contracts to underwrite new supply. It's kind of indicative of the boom-bust cycle of very capital-intensive markets like the LNG market. So I think as we go forward, we're going to continue to see that kind of cycle. But here's the most important thing. The entry of the United States into that marketplace is more about driving liquidity in the global market space so that pricing is more transparent. It actually matriculates more rapidly to market participants. It's not long-term contract, destination and flexible sort of driven type of market, right? It's more of a market that you'll have long-term contracts, so it's underpinned financing, but there's a lot more flexibility in what happens once a cargo's loaded. So as you go forward, you're just going to look at a much more liquid, much more transparent market that is generally more friendly to investors. That all said, you still need to have the right prices, the right arbitrage in order to get financing to develop a new facility. So that is not going to change, but it's a standard sort of commercial operation. Particularly, I mean, the best analog I can give you is when you think about drilling wells for natural gas in North America, you do it because there's an economic opportunity, right? There's actually a profit motive, right? So when you look at the global LNG market, it's going to look very much like that going forward.
Interesting. You know, I've seen, we sit today, I didn't check natural gas since we were talking, but give or take $4.25. A month ago, hardly $3. A year ago, probably $2.50. And now I see quite a few talented economists predicting 6, then 8. And I saw over the weekend a couple of people calling $10 decatherm nat gas, driven by almost two phenomena. One, the use of nat gas domestically for power gen related to growth in the grid, compounded by all these LNG plants with open export markets. Can you see a world where nat gas becomes that expensive?
Not for the long term. I can certainly see cycles where you'll hit relatively expensive supply in North America because of a cold winter combined with cold, you know, in Europe, for example, that's really driving, you know, high LNG demand, something like that. But when you get into the $6, $7, $8 range, you begin to incentivize a lot of dry gas production that has been pretty quiet in North America. Think about regions like the Haynesville Shale, for example, which is pretty close, you know, northern Louisiana, pretty close to all this LNG export capability. If you start pushing price up there, you're going to see a lot of operators really start to go heavy into just dry gas developments. I mean, currently we produce more wet gas or associated gas than we export. So when you think about associated gas, that's gas that's coming out with the oil. The gas is not driving the investment. As a matter of fact, we still don't capture all that gas. There's still flaring. There's still reinjection. So when you get into that $6 to $8 window, it becomes a lot more commercially viable to think about installing all the gathering and takeaway capacity you need, because now the gas monetization of that gas is, it just looks very different in that environment, which is why I don't see us ever getting into a long-term $8 to $10 price environment. In fact, there's a lot of gas that hasn't been tapped yet up in Canada. And there's a long historical trade between the US and Canada. And Canadian gas in that price environment will do everything it can to find its way into the lower 48.
Time for a break. We'll get back to our conversation with Dr. Kenneth Medlock from the Center for Energy Studies at Rice University's Baker Institute after this.
Zero is a big number. Getting close to a zero emissions future starts with using the broadest mix of clean, low-carbon energy sources. You might be surprised to know that propane produces a lot of energy for thousands of purposes and millions of people with virtually zero particulate matter, zero impact to the ozone, zero toxicity, and zero potential for storage-related contamination. It's low NOx and low CO2 to boot. Path to Zero is sponsored by Propane. Energy for everyone. Learn more at propane.com.
Welcome back. We're talking to Dr. Ken Medlock on energy markets and policy. A lot of optimism around both nuclear. I'll say nuclear, and we can break it down into SMRs. We can break it down into fission or fusion. I'm still very confused about how we can have commercial contracts for fusion. But a lot of excitement around nuclear, and then to a degree, some excitement around geothermal. Do you have opinions on what's realistic and maybe where that provides more energy short-term and long-term?
I do. In fact, and I'll sort of preface this by saying I was asked a really interesting question at a conference I was speaking at in Tokyo in December of last year. So we were just a month out of the elections of November. I had the moderator of that conversation ask me a really interesting question. He said, "Now that you've elected the anti-climate president, what do you think will happen with decarbonization efforts in the United States?" And this was a question he had not, you know, usually moderators will tell you what they're going to ask you beforehand, right? And I was like, "Oh, that's interesting." And I had to think for a second. I said, "You know, I think ironically, you could probably see a more concerted push to long-term baseload decarbonization than you saw under the Biden administration." And he said, "What do you mean?" And I said, "Well, think about what this administration is poised to do." So by the time we got to December, we knew Burgum was going to be you know, nominated for Interior. We knew Wright was going to be nominated for Energy. I said, if you look at what Trump is doing, he's actually putting in place individuals that have a longstanding positive view around advanced nuclear and geothermal. So when you think about what role the DOE and what role Interior could play, they actually stand to play a significant role in both of those technologies. So you can think about from the DOE perspective, repurposing the loan program office to support those types of things. You think about DOI, it's about permitting on federal lands for things like geothermal, right? So you look at all that and you say, wow, there could be a really interesting shift politically away from wind and solar, but towards different energy assets that the U.S. actually has relatively strong control of the supply chains to support development. And that's a really important point when you think about energy security and the whole, you know, Make America Great Again movement. The idea there is we'll look for what the U.S. has potential strength in and expect this administration to lean into those things. Historically, we know how small modular reactors work. In fact, we do have a comparative advantage in that space. They're deployed on naval vessels all over the world, right? So when you think about, you know, submarines, aircraft carriers, these sorts of things, yeah, we know how they operate, and we're at an interesting inflection in time right now where there's a lot of individuals that are retiring from the U.S. Navy, moving into the civilian workforce, and guess what they're really interested in doing? Bringing that small modular and micronuclear technology into the civilian sort of applications. Layer on top of that, what we just saw with Project Janus, which was announced by the Department of Defense, where they're going to contract for commercially constructed micronuclear reactors to deploy, you know, at forward bases and operating locations all over the world for the U.S. military. You've now got a sort of center mass that's going to drive orders that can lead to production of these things. And companies like Westinghouse really stand to benefit from that, because if they have to start building these things because the orders come, there's going to be a lot of learning by doing, just like there has been with wind and solar and every other technology that's ever been developed. When you start to make it, you figure out how to make it less, you know, in a more efficient, less costly way. And so as we go forward on solar, I see that very much as being real in the runway in terms of what's going to happen. Now, will you see a lot of this deployed across the United States in the next 3 years? Probably not. I mean, there's still a lot of regulatory encumbrance to overcome. But I think this administration is going to do a lot to try to clear that deck. On geothermal, it's still going to be very much connected to where you see the opportunity in the subsurface. So the geology still has to be right. But an interesting point about advanced geothermal that I don't think everybody really connects with is the companies that are really driving this space are companies that are led by individuals who are from the oil and gas industry. So when you think about advanced geothermal, you're talking about deep drilling horizontally. You turn the bit, go horizontally, stage the fracs. Think about how fractures communicate between each other. So you can actually create a circuit, a loop with stuff you're injecting and stuff you're withdrawing to make steam. And all of that know-how is already in this country, because it's reflective of all of the things that have been happening in the upstream since the shale revolution really took hold 15 or so years ago. So it's a great example of where you've got all of the necessary pieces for it to work. It really is just about how do you get the cost down so it is a commercially viable option. And there's a lot of work going on in that space. And, you know, it's not surprising that right now there's a heavy focus on the Western states, because that's where, for the most part, electricity is expensive. So you can actually cut your teeth out there. But once they start to figure out how to get that cost down and scale this technology, I think you're going to see it potentially grow really rapidly, just because all the supporting infrastructure is in place.
Yeah, interesting. You know, nuclear has been, depending on how you measure it, sometimes 18, 19, 20% of the grid's output. Geothermal hardly makes a dent. We'll call it less than 1%. And that's being kind to it. I rarely see geothermal projections that are much more than 1%. Because to your point, do you see at least geothermal have the potential to become less than a niche in power gen?
I do. It's largely because of what I just said. I mean, the analog I can give you when I say supporting infrastructure, it's think about the shale revolution, right? People talked about shale in the early 2000s like it's never going to happen. As a matter of fact, when I first started looking at it, this was back in 05, 06, I was involved in one of the first resource assessments that was done for North American shale. And a lot of the stuff I was reading was, it was really interesting because it was dissertations written by, you know, geology PhD students that were written in the 40s about shale formation, what was there. And the long held belief was that commercially and technically it would never lead to a recoverable resource. Well, you never underestimate human ingenuity, right? We figured it out. And when you look at geothermal, there's an analog there, right? We've known for a long time where the hot rock is. We've known for a long time how to potentially access that as a resource. With shale, the reason it took off was not because we knew where the resource was. It was because all of the architecture above ground, all of the supporting infrastructure in terms of the service industry, the wells, the know-how, all of the subsurface engineering and geologic expertise, it was all already in place because of the depth of the service industry in the oil and gas space in the United States. So when shale actually found commercial footing, it was able to launch. You didn't have to build new supply chains. There was stuff already in place that you could just sort of attach to. It was leveraging a legacy infrastructure, more or less. Geothermal looks really similar simply because you're talking about applying oil and gas technology and know-how into a new space focused on power generation. And oh, by the way, the U.S. has a very well-developed power grid and well-established markets that can bring this stuff on board as soon as it's commercially viable very quickly. So yeah, I'm honestly pretty bullish about geothermal.
Certainly a well-developed power grid for stable power like geothermal power for sure, right? Yeah. All right, so let's talk. You've written one of my favorite lines. You talk about the energy. You call it a transition. I'll give you that. The energy transition will be slower and more complicated than most people expect.
So I usually talk. Absolutely, absolutely. So I usually talk about energy transitions. So I've taken this turn of phrase for over a decade now, and there's a very important reason why. When you look at the existing energy landscape around the world, there's nothing homogenous about it, right? If you look at the energy mix in Norway, it doesn't look like the energy mix in the UK. It doesn't look like the energy mix in China. It doesn't look like the energy mix in the United States. It's different everywhere for a very specific reason. When countries develop and they begin to build out their energy infrastructure to support economic activity and growth, they lean into what they have first. So this is where you get into something called the principle of comparative advantage, and you utilize the resources that you have access to that are the cheapest, can really drive activity. So once you understand that very basic point, it's hard to envision a world where everything looks the same. And that inherently brings complexity into the entire picture. So if I'm looking at a technology that has the potential to deliver electrons to a customer, that technology will have different uptake in different places around the world based on if you're relying on the sun, well, maybe the sun isn't a great resource 24/7, 365, right? Maybe the wind isn't a great resource 24/7, 365. Maybe there's a lot of seasonal variation. Maybe we've got to look at other opportunities in different places around the world. Think about hydro, nuclear, geothermal, natural gas. I mean, everything, coal. Coal is still a very intensely used source of energy to generate power. More so in the developing world than the developed world now, but that's because they're using what they have. So when you think about the complexity of energy transitions, you have to recognize that systems will always evolve, they always have, but economics matter. Supply chains matter. What can you develop in a resilient way so you can deliver energy services to industry, to commerce, to households in a sustainable and reliable way so that they can continue to grow? So growth is always, it's fundamental to this issue. And what that means is you'll see supply chains develop differently everywhere around the world. It means that you will see different energy sources adopted at different paces everywhere around the world. That creates commercial challenges farther upstream when you're thinking about promoting new technologies, developing them, delivering them, that basically create bumps in the road. So as you think about what the future looks like, you cannot disconnect it. You cannot disconnect the future of energy from economic growth, from where resources exist, from where comparative advantages exist in different types of industrial activities that maybe need more intensive industrial heat than others. I mean, all of these things matter. And it's kind of interesting because as an economist, these are things I've been talking about for a couple of decades, right? But it's interesting to watch the world start to come to the realization, yeah, it is more complicated. And notice I haven't used the word geopolitics once, but that adds another layer of complexity, and we cannot ignore that either.
Totally right. That is a great answer. I will enjoy listening to that answer once more, because I certainly agree with it completely. All right, let's think a little bit of, and I really, you talk about geopolitics, talk about at least U.S. politics, and I don't remember ever seeing such a transformative period from everything President Biden stood for, financed, green hydrogen, solar, wind, battery, to frankly everything President Trump probably tried to quickly dismantle, and now we operate under his one big beautiful bill. How have you seen that shift? And I might even take the liberty of asking you this question. What do you think happens in 2.5 years? Do you see a shift again? Or how have you seen it shift? And maybe what do you see happening over the next 4 or 5 year planning period anyway?
There's definitely been a shift directly attributable to President Trump's vision versus President Biden's vision. That is undoubtedly true. It's tangible. I mean, you've seen the rollback on subsidies for wind and solar in particular. You've seen a pretty aggressive stance taken on offshore wind. You've seen a very different view pushed forward in terms of using federal land to site wind and solar. That's where the Department of Interior, of course, gets involved. So you've seen a more aggressive push to really develop offshore oil and gas resources as well. That is politics. It's really that simple. But I think what's interesting, and I'll come back to something I commented earlier on, is around nuclear and geothermal, and even carbon capture, which we haven't discussed. But you know, having an EPA that's kicking primacy on Class VI wells much more quickly out to states could actually accelerate the use of carbon capture. Now, of course, in the One Big Beautiful Bill, I like to call it HR1 because that's what it is in the Federal Register. But in HR1, you know, they levelized the tax credit between Class 2 and Class 6 injection. So Class 2 is injection of CO2 for enhanced oil recovery. Class 6 is injection of CO2 for long-term or permanent storage. The only reason you'd ever move forward on a Class 6 well where you've got opportunity to do both, well, there isn't one. You'd only move forward if there is no opportunity to do Class 2, because there's no, you know, with Class 6, there's no value uplift. With Class 2, there is. So when you look at all that stuff, as it changes, and it changes investment priorities, because when you have subsidies or support in place for different technologies, you see investment capital flow to those technologies. Well, you're going to see investment capital stop flowing to wind and solar in the United States the way it was. It's going to start flowing more into advanced nuclear and geothermal and carbon capture initiatives. And that will create a very different landscape, where I think that as we move forward through the next administration beyond this one, depending on who's elected, you'll probably see a little bit more interest in wind and solar again. A little bit more interest in long-term storage of electrons. So not just the short-term sort of cycle up, cycle down battery technologies we have, but things that can store a charge for a long period of time and deliver for a long period of time. I think that's where you'll start to see the landscape shift, which quite frankly is at the end of the day a little bit more balanced. And it can lead to long-term, reliable, sustainable grids that I think customers want. I mean, the talking point now is not about green versus gray, right? The talking point right now is about affordability. And I don't think that's going away. So how do you actually get power costs down? And at the end of the day, that's really with a diversified portfolio of generation that can meet the needs of customers in real time.
Yeah. Yeah. Well said. All right, let's have a little fun. We do a couple things. And it's been really important as over the years we've asked this question and we go back and listen to them. It's fascinating to hear the answers. In just a moment, I'm going to hand you a magic wand. And I'm going to allow you to use that wand one time for one thing in the next 1 year. So all kinds of ones that in your mind would have the biggest impact on energy or perhaps energy policy. I'll go broader than that. Or even awareness. How would you use that wand?
Wow. My mind's going probably 100 different directions, but I think the one that would have the biggest impact on the energy landscape is one in which I could wave my magic wand and we figure out how to make carbon to value a viable commercial proposition. So what do I mean by that? Well, it's really this simple. What if we could capture carbon either in solid form or gaseous form and use it in advanced chemistries and advanced materials so that it becomes part of the built environment? The entire conversation around the future of energy changes dramatically, almost instantaneously, right? So we're not worried about using hydrocarbons anymore because hydrocarbons are for energy and for materials, energy and for chemistry, right? So when you think about that, to me, that's the thing that changes the nature of the discussion. It addresses, you know, long-term concerns around emissions and climate change. It addresses long-term concerns about affordable energy. It addresses long-term concerns about adequate materials for, you know, building cities and roads and hospitals and everything else. And oh, by the way, it utilizes what nature deemed long before we were ever here to be the most efficient carrier of hydrogen, which is the carbon atom. So it's a way to think about a future of energy that's very different than the one most people fathom today. So to me, that if you gave me that power, that's probably what I would use that magic wand for.
That's fascinating. And as a guy who does study the built environment and carbon, I want to think that through, but I agree. That's a great use of that wand.
Hey, there's a lot of research at universities all over the world that are looking at, including here at Rice, ways to actually take carbon as a byproduct from a methane pyrolysis technology, for example, and use it to make carbon nanotubes that you can spin into all sorts of very useful materials. And you know, some of those are already commercially viable, but typically only in very high-end applications because it's expensive. So like Formula One is a huge fan of this stuff, as you might imagine, right? Just because you can lightweight things. But it's got a lot of potential. We just need to figure out how to make it commercially viable in lower end sort of applications. And then I think the whole discussion changes.
Yeah, I found the whole concept of carbon capture to be really complicated for me. We've been working on it for probably 5 years. Certainly great inroads, as most science makes. Still a long ways to go. That's a fascinating use of your wand, and thanks for that suggestion. It was a great one.
Sure. I mean, look, Mother Nature figured out carbon to value long before we were here. That's what photosynthesis is, right? So it's doable. We've just got to figure out how to do it and make money, right? Because that's the only way you're going to get industrial activity there.
We'd love to thank you for sharing your time, your expertise, your thoughts by planting a tree in a national forest of your choosing. Now, I know here in Houston, you got some great ones. You got Davy Crockett National Forest, Sam Houston National Forest, but it's your choice. Is there a place that comes to mind as we think about planting a tree in your honor?
There is. So my wife went to the University of Vermont, and there is a forest up there called the Green Mountain Forest. And to me, that would be a phenomenal place to do this just in her honor. So that would be my choice.
Oddly enough, I was there 2 weeks ago. Fortunately, it was a much warmer day than it is today. But it is a beautiful place. And one, in fact, that will be easy to give you your wish. So thanks. All right, before we wrap up, I mean, there's so much going on at Rice, at the Center for Energy Studies, in your own personal writings and work. What would you like our listeners to know about how to follow you or follow Rice or follow the Center for Energy Studies?
Yeah, I mean, the best way to follow everything we do is go to our website and sign up for our monthly newsletter, which is Energy 360. It's a sort of monthly synopsis of the different things we're working on, writing about, events that are upcoming that are generally open to the public. That's one of the things that I take a lot of pride in is we don't charge people to come to our events. We're at an academic institution and knowledge should be free. So we try to make sure that everybody can find out what we're doing and make it easily accessible. So that would be the simplest thing to do. We have multiple programmatic disciplines underneath the center. Some are focused on regional geopolitics. Other are focused specifically on different forms of energy. So oil, gas, electricity, work in minerals and materials, work on sustainability and resilience, geopolitical programs focused on Europe, Asia, Middle East, Africa, Latin America. So we kind of cover the world. Back to sort of how we open the conversation, Energy Insights, it's available on our website. You can actually see it from our site directly. It's downloadable as a flip book. So it's kind of nice, easy to access and view. But because of that, it has actually been viewed over 30,000 times since we published it, which was in early October, in 56 different countries around the world. So it is specifically meant to be accessible, and it's a great way to get connected. So I appreciate you actually raising that to open this conversation. But yeah, you can follow us just by signing up for Energy 360 on our website.
Well, I'm primarily a technologist, so I love talking about technology, but I even love better talking about technology with economists. And so I appreciate that because you cannot really have one without the other. So, Ken, thank you so much for being with us today on Path to Zero. And I look forward to following you and studying you a little bit more. And I hope everyone enjoys this conversation as much as I did. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tucker. I really appreciate it. It's been a pleasure to be here.
If you enjoyed this conversation with Dr. Ken Medlock and other guests on Path to Zero, be sure to follow or subscribe on your favorite podcast app or on YouTube and leave us a quick review. It really helps more people discover the show. You can also find every Path to Zero interview plus articles and insights on clean energy innovation on the Substack newsletter at pathtozero.substack.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time on Path to Zero.